It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
I hope all of our listeners are enjoying a great summer here in Interior Alaska. After last winter, we certainly deserve a break. Welcome to the program we call Alaska Tracks, where we listen to excerpts of interviews with veteran hunting guides and wildlife biologists and hunters and fishermen. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I serve as your host for this program. Today's guest is Ken Fanning of Yakutat. We've heard from Ken the last 2 weeks, but he still has more great stories to share. You may recall at the end of last week's episode, Ken talked about losing a rifle in a coastal river. Listen carefully today when he shares the rest of the story. He also talks about the tragic loss of a pilot friend.
So I turned and I'm walking. This hill is dirt and shale, like a combination of a coarse black sand. I'm walking in their footprints on the top of this hill, and I'm almost to the very end of it. And I got my pack on, which is not very heavy, and I got my rifle in my hand. And it's been raining and raining and raining, and the mountain says goodbye. I mean, and I'm right in their footprints, and down we go. And so I'm headed down toward this river, and the mountain's going with me. I've got this sand and mud stuff up to about my knees or my thighs. And I'm in a chute that's about, there's 6 or 8 feet wide that's sliding me down this hill. The river's a raging river, by the way, so I know we gotta stop this or get away from this deal before we get to the river, or it's gonna be a problem situation. First thing I decided to do is, okay, let's throw the rifle, because all I gotta do is throw the rifle over here a few feet and get it out of my way. And I just started to throw it, and another landslide hit me in the back, and the rifle went right in front of me, and I could see it as we crossed it. It was about 6 or 8 foot of mud and sand and me that went sliding across, so the rifle's at the bottom of that. We went another 50 yards, and I stopped about 8 feet from the edge of the river. The slide stopped. I didn't do anything. It just stopped. It had gotten down to the end and lost its momentum. And I was a little over chest deep, solid. I had both of my arms up, and it took me close to 3 hours to get myself out of there. I was just completely pinned, buried in sand, not to your neck, but I had my arms up in this wet mud sand stuff. And by this time, this slide is 50 yards wide, and my rifle's someplace back up that hill, but it's obvious I'm not going to find that rifle. I get out of that mess, just digging out with your hands. My fingers are all bloody and whatnot. I can't get to anything else. And I dig out enough to where when I can finally wiggle out of my pack, then I could get some implements to dig with and get all the way out. Walk back to camp, and of course I just look like I've been through a train wreck, and they're like, what the hell happened to you? And I said, well, you know, smart Alaskan guy, that's lost my goddamn rifle. I mean, how can you lose your rifle? So we patched up the wounds and got dry clothes and all that stuff and went to bed that night. She's raining and raining, I mean, it's really pouring. I wake up about 4 in the morning or something. I'm, goddamn it, I ought to go down there and check that boat. And I do, and it's dark. And I walk out just in time to see a 3/4 sunken boat with the motor underwater, but it's got enough flotation in it that it's going around the corner out into the lake, 75 yards away. Now, this lake we're talking about is 12 miles long, 4 miles wide, and it's laden with icebergs the size of this house. I mean, the icebergs are out there, and there goes the boat. What had happened was that with all that rain, the river had raised so much that it had raised above where we had tied the boat. The wind had blown it into shore and set it on an angle and then blown waves into it and sunk it, and it slid off. So here it goes, and there's no way I can get it. So I run back up to the camp, which was a couple hundred yards away, inform those guys what had happened, and that's one of those times that I had an opportunity to walk in an area that I wouldn't walk. By going around this lake, it's about 17 miles, and it's mostly sheer cliffs. So someplace you have to go way back in. And that took all day, of course, and then I got to the road, and there was nobody there, so then I got to walk 9 miles in the road till I could get a ride and get into town and jump in a Super Cub, and I made a parachute, took a bottle of J&B Scotch, because that's what Jack always drank, and a bottle of Chivas Scotch, and made these parachutes and flew back over there and dropped the bottles of whiskey and let them know that I was alive and that I was going to get another boat and back tomorrow. So I got another boat and went back up there, and we finished the hunt, and everybody got their bears and turned out fine. That was in 1976. I still have that camp to this day. It's much nicer now. At that time of day, we're just fly tents. But now it's tent frames with wooden floors and 4-foot walls. Year before last, we were hunting up there in the spring, and I was there with a hunter, and I also had Ronnie Warren. He's a master guide. In the Camp Valley, which has a delta that's about 7 miles across of nothing but sand delta where those river's outlets are, 3 miles below where my rifle was, he walks across and finds about an inch of the barrel sticking out of the sand. That thing had come down the river, moved across that 7 mile delta, and it's hanging up over in my gift shop. We found it 20 years later. She's not exactly in shooting shape, but it's amazing how things come back to you.
One thing that we didn't talk very much about were your activities with the Trappers Association. Can you remember a specific thing? I know that you handled a newsletter for several years.
I'm not sure why that is, but in all the deals, and it's true with the Trappers Association, it's true with the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, with the NRA, it's certainly true with anything that happens here in Yakutat. Somehow, of the characters that enjoy hunting and fishing and trapping, I end up being the guy that does a lot of the legwork and footwork and recording stuff, and I can't type for diddle, but I ended up typing and cutting stuff out and pasting, and my memory's so bad that I think in the early days particularly, I wrote things down or kept things, mostly because I knew that in 3 years I'd forget them, and that's in fact why I started the hunting newsletter of my own, because I knew that just a few years later I'd forget who the clients were or who the guides were or exactly how many sheep we saw up around this corner or that corner. You know, I was one of the original founders of the association and board of directors of the association. Undoubtedly, somebody just said, we need a newsletter, and are there any volunteers? And there undoubtedly weren't any, and so, you know, Ron Long or Norm or somebody said, well, Fanning, you can write.
That formal, huh?
Yeah, I think it was about that formal. So I think that's how it happened. And I always was passionate about it and always really enjoyed it and really felt that it was a worthwhile thing, and it provided an avenue for people who don't normally exchange ideas to be able to meet each other and exchange ideas. I just kind of got roped into it and enjoyed doing it. Now I'm lazy and I don't do that kind of stuff as much anymore. And it really is a valuable thing because people who are loners, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but people who really enjoy the wilderness and trapping and the experiences frequently don't have interactions where they share them. I mean, they're not the kind of personalities that grab a guy and start bragging about this or that. So I think it really is valuable to have an association and get a lot of things down in print and photographs. I don't even know what all's in here, but these are some old trapping photos on our line. That's me and Jill. This is out when we ran that line up all the way to Clear. There's a bunch of fox and wolverine. And
so this would have been
early 70s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's Jill and a bunch of our furs. And there's one of my trap line cabins. There's Ron Long, and that's when I was up working on his trap line. That's a trapping story, I'd tell you. That's the wolverine. That's where I came up with that Beaver Lodge double set. And that son of a bitch bit through my bunny boots and just damn near put me in a world of hurt. That's when I found out that despite what doctors tell you that humans do have the same ability as cats, you actually can retract your claws. I swear I took my toenails in so far they went up to the heel of my foot. You always want to do things better, and so you're trying to figure out how to dispatch animals in a humane manner, and you're always trying to figure out how to do it so you don't leave any bruises and holes in the fur. And of course, the logical thing to do is shoot the damn thing, but I didn't do that. That year, I tried to dispatch everything with either a conibear or a snare. And so this particular wolverine, I had gone and got a stick, and as you can see, it looks like a D9 cat got loose on that beaver house. So I had set my 330 conibear, and I was going to snap him on the head to kill him, so that I could show that you could kill him quick and easy and no holes, right? So I got the conibear on him, and as you know, wolverine's neck's real thick, and their skull's fairly straight back in that area. Little rascal was able to twist his head just right to where I thought, well, son of a gun, he's going to come out of that damn conibear. Of course, he's still in the leg hole. So I went up and stepped on the two jaws of the conibear to push back down because I thought he was going to slide out. Well, that was a good idea, except that he then turned his head, even though I was stepping down on it, and latched on to the end of my goddamn bunny boot, completely biting through it from both the bottom and the top, and I pulled back. That was a fortunate move, but it wasn't one that I could ever recommend for people to do because it was obviously pretty stupid. But in the process of doing that, he did happen to turn his neck and expose it in such a way that I had cut off his wind and that did dispatch. But I never did write that down as one of my recommended ways of doing that. I built a cabin, the stupidest thing, and geez, it worked great. I was on the Tatalina, and I found this hot springs. And the way I found it, I was looking for beaver areas, and I was way out in the middle of nowhere. came around a corner and promptly found my snow machine 6 feet underwater. And me too. Couldn't figure out how the hell that happened because I've been digging beaver holes all day and the ice was all 3 foot thick. And so that's how I discovered the hot springs. Spent quite a bit of time, got the snow machine back up out of there, and I built this neat little cabin. This hot springs was just a little bitty crickle of a creek. I mean, it wasn't a foot wide and a foot deep, but that's where it came into the river. So I just followed that up a little ways. After the snow melted that year, I hiked in there and swam across the river with my chainsaw and whatnot. It's got to be the world's smallest trapper's cabin. I think it's about 6 foot by 8 foot. And I dammed up that little stream to where underneath the whole cabin was a little hot tub. And then I put a little trap door in it. It was the neatest thing in the world. From laying on the bunk, you could have your feet in that hot deal, and, well, you couldn't move to cook or do anything else. You basically had to do everything from the one little bunk. Of course, again, like a lot of my things, I wasn't real smart, and it took about 4 or 5 years to have that little log cabin fall apart and rot. But that was a neat idea. We're good for a little time.
You mentioned flying a couple of times, but you never flew.
When I originally came to Alaska, I think I described that to you, but one episode in my life that I left out was the year before I got married. I worked for an outfit called the Dalton Gang, and we're the ones that put that haul road up north of the Yukon up into the Brooks Range. And anyway, so my best friend there was a guy by the name of Beck. And we were running these cat trains and hauling these rigs and setting them up before the, what we call the Gator Gobblers, came from Oklahoma. You know, so we'd build the locations, and Bill Hutchinson was flying for us. He was a wolf guy. To make a long story short, I stayed up there all that winter. We built those camps for Colorado Oil and put that haul road in and came home and got married, and we came up the highway, and our first experience that winter was going to be going hunting down in Nana. Beck's were from Nana. Jill and I were in Fairbanks, and we were to drive down. Joe and his brother Bum were in Fairbanks that weekend, and they had invited us to go on a winter caribou hunt. I don't remember it now. It was in January or February. So they jumped back in his plane. Joe was flying, and they headed out to Nanana, and Joe and I got in our new El Camino that we had gotten when we got married and had driven up the highway with, and we're driving down to their place. Get about to Skinny Dick's halfway in there, hear on the radio that there's been a plane crash, and they actually announced that Bum Beck had gotten killed, and that Joe Beck's in the hospital with serious injuries. Naturally whip the car around and drive back to the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and go running in the door, and here's Bum Beck, who I don't know. So Joe Beck's obviously dead. The funeral down there was you couldn't come unless you were drank whiskey, spit, chewed, smoked, cussed, and had to have blue jeans and a Pendleton shirt. And there was about 400 of us that descended upon Nanana for that funeral. You know, it was a very fitting and a very Alaskan deal. One of those things that, you know, you get choked up about thinking about to this day.
This man seemingly went everywhere and did everything. Most outdoorsmen can only dream of living the life that Ken did. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Many thanks to our sponsors for supporting Alaska Tracks. Now back to finish up our interview with Ken Fanning of Yakutat. In this segment, Ken tells us about his decision to not become a pilot. He also shares a few stories about another of the guides he worked for. He finishes the interview by expressing his gratitude for the life he's lived.
But in any event, at the conclusion of that, Jill told me, knowing how scatterbrained I am, that if I ever wanted to own airplanes, she would allow me on the condition that I would promise her never to fly. So I did. She has, and we do. I love to fly, and I do own airplanes, and I spend most of my time being worried about who's got the bigger bear, the littler bear, or which camp's got coffee, and who needs to get back to their wedding anniversary, and this and that and the other. And in the entire career that I've had, I've always left commercial flying up to folks that are doing nothing but that. And it's been a bunch easier, too. It's also kind of a wimp-out deal. Number one, it's a hell of a lot less expensive because you have less wreck. Over the years, I've lost Len Cass and Clark Engel were two of my best friends. We've lost hundreds of real good friends in the guiding business in the last 30 years. Pilots die in Bush, Alaska. They just do. Plane crashes happen. So I've stayed away from that. And I'm glad, but I love to fly, and I go flying all the time. Kip's a pilot. He flies a lot, and he's a very cautious pilot. Mother still has a minor heart attack every time he steps out the door and gets in the plane, but I think that's what mothers are going to do.
Now, you mentioned Lynn Castle, mm-hmm. and his name is pretty famous there in Fairbanks.
I can tell you a bunch of funny stories with Lynn. I had just gotten my guide's license. Lynn was just setting up the Wood River camp. Pay and Save opened in 1972, and Fairbanks and Don McCombie had let me have a receiving station. Hunters would bring in anything they shot, and we would skin it and flush it, and then we'd ship it to Heads West in Denver or Jonas Brothers or wherever somebody wanted, for anybody that didn't know how to take care of hides. And it was hunting season, but I wasn't going to go out that year. I'd already done my assistant guiding with everybody, and I wasn't going to go out. I don't remember what day, the 10th of September, some Mo Castle calls, and he's got an assistant guide that broke a leg, and he got hunters on today's plan. He absolutely has to have somebody, but it'll only be for a week. And I said, well, I can't do that, Lynn. I'm sitting here, Jill and I are running the shop. I can't do it. Oh, no, but I got to. Can I? You're the only guy that I know. You know the area. You know the this. You can do this. And so I talked it over to Jill, and she didn't like the idea. But by then, I had taught her, and she could skin everything, and she could turn lips and ears and do everything. She didn't like it, but she'd do it. So I took off on that little deal, and you know exactly what happened. 7 days became 21 days. I don't know why I still have a wife, but when I got back, every person in Fairbanks I knew that had a freezer had a full moose head or moose cape in it, because she could not turn moose noses and lips and ears and wouldn't. Her hands were bloody and raw and cracked. I mean, her face was from crying. She was just around the clock. Because you know how some of these characters, these first-time hunters, they bring in a black bear hide, and it's got 5 pounds of maggots crawling around in it. And so she got to deal with all of that herself. That was the biggest mistake. I mean, I had her trained good, too, and that's the last time she ever touched a skinning knife, a fleshing knife, or anything. She wouldn't anymore cut anything now. Whew, she was hot. So that was my number one bone to pick with Castle. I never can forget that one time when I had the little trapping supply going, we'd taken this great big flatbed truck. This Rob Cook guy actually did it. Started back in Indiana and Kentucky, and he had cut a bunch of hickory that we were going to sell up there for dog sleds, and stopped at every major trap supply place. We got all the traps we could buy because there weren't any. Nobody could get any. And, of course, several gallons of mink and fox urine and every kind of oddball stink bait that you can imagine. And I've got the same stories about spilling those on my living room carpet that every trapper does, you know. But I'll never forget, we got this supply bag going. I'm running my trapper. We're fat, dumb, and happy. In my driveway there on Chena Pump Road, here comes old Lynn Castle. Oh, and he is distraught. He's crying. I mean, he's just come in there at Phillips Field and crashed his 172 into a 206 and a Beaver and some other six-passenger airplane. But anyway, he's got about $400,000 worth of bills that he has to figure out how to pay immediately. And old Jim Smith is one of the guys that guides for Lynn, and Jim was the best trapper that I knew of in interior. You know, he'd get 20 to 60 wolves a year, but that's all he did. I mean, that's all he did. He didn't sleep. He just ran his snow machine hundreds of miles. Some of them he ran down, some of them he snared, some of them he trapped, but he was just a wolf nut. So for some reason, Castle has got it in his mind that he can make all this money back for these airplanes trapping wolves. Well, Lynn's never trapped in his life. Of course, the first thing I did was explain to him that the little airplane accident he had been in had obviously addled his brain, because he wasn't about to make $400,000 trapping wolves or anything else, you know. Oh, no, no, Jim's going to tell me all there is. Anyway, so what he needed, of course, was a loan. And I had the only wolf traps in town, and he needed a bunch of wolf traps and a bunch of snares. I gave them to him, and he did not pay for his airplane's wolf trap. By the end of the year, he had caught four. I never seen anybody that could fall into shit as bad as he could, and he'd always somehow come out. I mean, he was just a thinking and a wheeling and a dealing. But I think that was about the funniest thing I ever heard, was when an Alaskan like him came in and really thought that he was going to pay that kind of a bill off wolf trap. And I just shook my head. Well, I'll give you some traps, but I think you better go talk to a banker, because there ain't nothing I know that you can do to cover that problem that quick. And I worked with Lynn for several years. We were right next door, and I'd take his bear hunters down here and if they wanted a brown bear, and that was before he had his Kodiak area. Old Bob Elliott was a pretty good pilot, but he was very cautious. And after everybody knew I worked for Loshi, they'd always try to pick my brain about flying, but I'm not a pilot. They'd always, would Loshi do this and would Loshi do that? And I'd say, yep, no, yeah, he'd land there, no question about it. Loshi would not do a lot of the things Castle would do. Castle would just do stupid stuff. I mean, Castle was a wonderful guy and a real promoter and an ambassador, and he could get himself out of anything, and he had a really good operation and a good hunk of country. But he was not a good pilot. He just wasn't. I mean, there are good pilots and bad pilots. So I remember being up in the Alaska Range with Elliot. We were guiding up there in the East Fork, and we'd been over at Mount Hayes. And I wanted to move these couple of hunters, and they were young guys, and they could cover some ground. And we had covered all the ground that we could cover, and we just needed to be in a different area. So he hadn't been into this one camp that he'd got spooked at. He had crashed a plane up there once before, and so he hadn't been there for several years. And he's got me with him in the Super Cub, and he's circling this strip, right? It's in a delta, and there's this rivulet of water running through the strip, and he's going round and round and round and round and round, looking and looking and looking, and he turns back to me and he says, "Did Loshi land there?" I said, "Well, about a half hour ago." You know, on either side of that little creek. That pissed him off. And so in we went, and then I filled the hole up in the middle of the runway, and he brought the clients up, and we went out and got two sheep the next day. But Oloshi was the absolute epitome of reckless abandon. I'm sure pilots go through different stages in their flying life, but I believe that he was a very, very good pilot. When I was with him was just the last couple, 3 years, right before he got put out of business, thank goodness. Yeah. But I honestly believe he didn't care if he lived or died on every trip. I mean, he was just beyond the edge. I'm going to land there, even though it doesn't make good sense. And he'd do it time and time and time and time again.
Was there anybody with agencies that you'd like to comment about, either good or bad? Any fish and game people or game warden or that you interacted with?
You know, I have never had any problems with game wardens. I've had lots of problems with permitting people. We never used to have any kind of problems. They started that tagging program up in the Alaska Range. So I had some discussions with him, because after they'd shoot those bears and put them tags on it, even though they'd tell me that I was nuts, we've had lots of grizzlies and their offsprings that previously never touched any of our camps that just became absolutely irate at human smells and used to destroy him. But I didn't have any big disagreements with him, other than I told him that I thought that caused it, and he assured me that it didn't, and I thought he was nuts, and so that was fine. Ray Arnett was a guy that was a commissioner of Fish and Game in California, became a deputy secretary of the Interior, and he came to Alaska, and I have real fond memories, and I think he helped the Trappers Association and professional hunters out quite a bit, and had taken him hunting. I'm like everybody that has had some interactions with fish and game folks in the field or license checkers, troopers. You get young guys that don't know much about what they're doing and sometimes they're a little bit rude, but all of my experiences have been pretty good and beneficial. I mean, I had a real good relationship. Wayne Heimer's really the only guy that I dealt with in the department from a sheep hunting standpoint. I'd keep records of different things for him, and I'd turn in all my game counts every year. Personally, have had lots and lots of dealings with the Forest Service. It's just almost really not even worth commenting on. It's so frustrating, and the government is working so hard to make sure that people can't share Alaska and enjoy it. And I don't think that what they're doing, the rules and regulations and stuff that I see going on, is not relative to conservation of resources or stewardship of resources. It's more of flexing bureaucratic muscle, and I think that's a real negative thing. So I'm not anxious to talk about that. I think somebody ought to just kick them all out of here. Don Young had a bill in a few years ago, and that was to move the headquarters for the Forest Service in Alaska down to Portland. He and everybody else in Congress has been aware of my battles with the Forest Service, so he called me up and asked me what I thought of that bill. And I told him I thought it was a lousy bill. And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I thought you'd be the first one in favor of that, moving them to Portland." I said, "Shit, that's not near far enough away. Russia's too close." That's the only problem I got with that bill. Anyway, so that's how mad at him I am. I'm so happy to be here where I'm at, and I just don't let things like that get me as riled as I used to. You know, the 24 and 25-year-old kids that they just brought in from California that are now the new river rangers or who are now the new experts in bear relationships can't possibly know my relationship with the animals and the area. So they're pretty likely to be making stupid comments, and just not worthwhile for me to get excited about it.
Is there some way to sum all this up? Nearly 40 years you've been here and what it's all meant?
Well, I'm damn glad that I got here when I did. I feel sorry for my son, and I wish I was here probably a little bit earlier. Alaska has been really, really, really good to me and really, really good to Jill and wonderful to us as a couple and as a family. You know, the wilderness experiences I've had are worth more than anything money can buy or anything that I could have imagined. And I really do feel fortunate to have escaped death as many times as we did. But I'm telling you, I'm just grateful every day I wake up and see what's around me here. And obviously, we've been lucky, and a lot of people think that I got some kind of business secret, and I don't have a business secret. I mean, we work hard, and we put in long hours, and always have, and undoubtedly always will. But we've been pretty fortunate. We've had trap lines that certainly did not pay for themselves. And I've had bear hunts that certainly did not pay for themselves. We just happen to be in a location now that really is generating a very good income and is a good, successful fishing lodge, and Alaska's been real, real good to us. So I guess to sum it up, I'd encourage anybody that's listening to keep the bureaucracy down and keep the wild areas wild and yet accessible to you, so that if you have an opportunity to see and feel the things that I did, I think it will just give you a much better life, and I think you'll enjoy it. You're going to have to be able to laugh at yourself, though, because I think the best teacher is our own mistake. So if you're still alive to laugh at your own stupidity, I think a life in the outdoors is, even today, a really, really good life. I just can't imagine how anybody could be luckier than to be in Alaska. I guess I'm just grateful. I don't have any great philosophical tidbits yet. I'm too young. But I'll undoubtedly have some another 20 or 30 or 40 years from now if we make it that long.
We'll come back and do it again.
Good.
We've now listened to Ken Fanning for 2.5 programs. I hope you've enjoyed his stories as much as I have. Tune in again next week. We'll shift to another in our long list of outdoor heroes here on Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.